Very good. Oh, there's no questions. A nice easy night. Uh-oh. Okay. Let's get into it. Dear Ajahn, just like the nature of water can only be understood by a frog, once he or she leaves, wouldn't the nature of non-self only be clearly understood by the stream winner, since for non-return and arahats, it would be just how things always have been? Thank you. Yeah, sort of. Don't really quite understand what you're saying there, but it's when you, nature of non-self, that is actually when you get your first understanding of this, you get the right view, and then later, they have a simile, the best simile which I like for the stream winner and the non-returners and the arahats, is like the simile of the person who is drowning at sea, the shipwrecked sailor. And a shipwrecked sailor, he manages to splash around, keep his head above water, and he can see dry land in the distance. That's like a stream winner where you can have some safety, you're not going to drown. And so once you're a stream winner, you see the Dhamma, it's in the distance, then of course you start swimming towards it. And when you get close enough to the shore, you don't need to swim anymore, you can stand up in the surf, you can feel something solid underneath, so you can wade to the shore, that's the non-returner. And the arahat, sitting on the dry land, under a coconut tree, with a nice, refreshing cup of tea with condensed milk. Or whatever else you like. So, that's one of the nicest ones. You understand non-self as a stream winner, but that understanding sometimes comes and sometimes goes because it hasn't totally seeped into your perception and thoughts. So still, one sometimes old habits prevail. So a good example of that is Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. And after 25 years with the Buddha, you know, he was attached to the Buddha, almost like a father figure. And so when the Buddha passed away, Ananda just, basically, he'd lost it. He just said, the Dhamma is just, I can't see the Dhamma because I'm missing my teacher so much. He was a stream winner. He knew non-self, but the past habits, conditionings overcame that wisdom. It came back again soon. He understood that, you know, he'd lost, he hadn't seen the Dhamma. So you get the right view first of all, but then sometimes the old views overcome that. But it's only a matter of time before the right view prevails. And how you view, that's always how you perceive. And how you perceive, that's also just how you think. So it's what's called the vipalasas, the perversions of view, perception and thought. And once you're wrong thought, that means you get wrong views because it's the thoughts which reinforce your views. And the views, that's how you perceive things. And then perception is what builds up your thoughts. So never ever think that views are always, or rather perceptions, are always pure. They're always bent before you even see things. So that's one of the ways to understand that. Anyway, Dhirajan, the other night you interestingly mentioned that the Buddha might have been a once returner. What are the evidence behind this? Because the Buddha's life as Siddhartha Gautama was his last birth. So he only returned once. That's the evidence. He was a once returner. He only came back once. That's pretty good evidence, isn't it? That was his last life. That's what once returners are. If you're a once returner and you come back to this world, this is your last life. It's obvious. Isn't it? And he said, this is my last life. He admitted it when he first was born. Seven steps, this is my last life, he said. And he gave the one finger sign. Not that one finger sign. This is my last life. So there's actually quite a bit of evidence behind that. Dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Crikey, I've got a certificate. Oh, no, somebody's been messing around here. police report form. Wanted. To Jhana Grove Happiness Centre. Silent. This is so serious. Guess who is wanted? Suspect's name. Noble Great Ajahn Brahma once so. Crime. Skilled in goodness, peaceful, calm and wise. Description of subject. Noble and perfectly enlightened one, enlightened one, enlightened one. There's no mention of... Oh, okay. Distinguishing features. Fat. No, they didn't put it in there. He's impeccable. Description of crime. He trains perfectly those who wish to be untrained. Untrained? He's a pure-hearted one having vision. Blah, blah, blah. Thank you, great teacher. Thank you, very great teacher. Very good. That's very, very nice. The priest report. So you're going to lock me up? Sentence me to Nibbana? Anyway, if we each create our own heaven and hell realms, does each person's heaven or hell only have one living being in it, or are there other living beings in there too? Thank you. Now that is an interesting question. Because traditionally they had Saka, who was the same as like Indra, the king of this heaven realm of the 33. And they described his palace. And this is a description. It had, I don't know, how many turrets in there? It had lots of, maybe 1,000 turrets. And every turret had 1,000 nymphs, basically floozies, his harem. And I think somebody actually, you know, when they were busy doing what they're supposed to be doing, like meditating, they actually counted how many women this Saka had. And it was like a huge amount. I mean, it was like 10 to the 12th or 13th or something. Now, that might be okay for Saka, but what about all those other women? For them, it would probably be a hell realm. So, was there real people in that realm? Or was it his fantasies and silly male delusions? What was it? So a lot of times those things will be created by that person. As his idea of what heaven would be. So, is it really that in the heaven realms that you are with that person all the time? So, suppose it was the hell realm. Suppose Bill Clinton went to hell, and would he have in his room Monica Lewinsky to keep him company for eternity? Would that? And so who'll be in hell, or both in hell, I don't know. But what these are, one of the important points in this is these realms are called mind-made realms. Mind-made realms. So the people you live with, the people you see, are the people you create. You make them according to what you think is desirable and what you think is punishment. Until such time comes that you realize, why do we create this punishment? Why do we create this silly idea of what heaven is? You create it. So if you died today, this evening, if you went outside and one of those thunderclaps just zapped you, where would you get reborn? Maybe if you're having good meditation, you get reborn in Jhana Grove, your mind-made Jhana Grove, with the same, no, different talks every evening, with different jokes for the next eternity. Never one story repeated ever. That might be what you create in your heaven realm, but we create these heaven realms. So they're not there waiting for us. They're blank sheets in which you create the heaven, you think, and also the people you would like to be with. They're not real, because you might like to be with them. But the question is, do they want to be with you? So I don't know how many of you have been married before. Imagine going to heaven and your ex was also really, really kind and good. So both of you get reborn in heaven. That would suck, wouldn't it? Thought you got rid of you. Anyway, during sitting meditation, whenever inner chatter occurs, if I unmindfully pay attention to it, I am interested in knowing its content, even just listening to one word or part of the word, I would get knocked out and nod off. Sometimes it would be followed by a sound in my head and jerking of the body, which would wake me up. But if I continue to follow the inner conversation, I would fall asleep for that duration of time. Can you please kindly explain what happened and why? Any tips so that I don't getting tricked to listen to the inner chatter? Thank you so much. The inner chatter. See if you can, again, slow down the inner chatter when you slow it down. You find there are many moments of silence. So it's doing something, but it's not bad. Because and if you want to listen to part of a word, today I was telling somebody in the interviews, now all the time we just always honor ourselves, you should do this, you should do that. You know, you're a good meditator, you shouldn't fall asleep. You know, you have been meditating for a long time, you shouldn't be that. So, always listen to the word should. But only listen to the first half of it. Shh. And don't go as far as the ud. Okay, no uds, just shh. So that's where you can listen to part of the word. Okay? Okay, and sometimes if you nod off, it just means you're tired. Take a break, for goodness sake. Last night someone mentioned amazing energy in the hall at Bodhinyana. What about the inverse? I went to one of the old World War II concentration camps in Europe and had the worst energy of anywhere I've ever been. How does energy linger in such places? Is it the residue of the original actions or the build-up of all the grief and sadness of visitors over the years, or both? One of the places which I always say has huge energy, and every time I go there, I always get great meditation, but also get very teary, and that's at the Vulture's Peak, you know, in Rajagaha, you know, where the Buddha spent a lot of his time. I like it there because it's just so simple, nice caves, really got some good energy there. And sometimes I think, why has it got such amazing energy? And it's not just, you know, just the person like myself just thinking, contemplating and getting inspired, but this is where the Buddha actually sat meditation. You know, this is actually where this great person actually sat. You don't have to pay money. It's not just some big shrine, you know, guarded by priests. Anyone can just go in there and just walk up and just sit down and meditate for as long as you wish. But it's not just that, because they have, I mentioned about the time. And what is it in the realm of the Sakha that there, I think, was it 500 years of human life is just one day for those gods. In other words, the time scale is just totally different than the human realm. So 500 years, only one day. So 2,500 years is only 5 days ago. Now for those gods, and that's not the very highest gods, only 5 days ago the Buddha became enlightened. They would remember it. They were still hanging around, protecting it. Because such a short time ago, the Buddha was there. And all these devas, powerful beings, looking after the place. So that's one of the reasons why they have energy. Good devas come around and protect it. Bad energy, sort of all the lower beings, and all those beings who died into such terrible, terrible, terrible circumstances. Some of those are probably still hanging around. Very, very bad energy in some places. Nice deva story to uplift you. This is one, I told that story the other day about the monk who was really hungry and the monk who needed a Pepsi Cola. And of course that one was me. But there's this story, and you know, I know the monk involved in this one, and it was one of the most amazing deva stories. Absolutely true. This was a American who was in the Peace Corps and in Thailand. And while he was in Thailand in the Peace Corps, you know, he was interested in Buddhism. And so he had the opportunity, you know, to ask, you know, he learnt Thai, some Thai anyway. And he was talking to the people, and he thought that having finished his, 2 years in the Peace Corps, that now he could go off and maybe be a monk for a month or two. Just like to finish off, you know, his cultural experience in Thailand. And maybe also, you know, sort of explore Buddhism deeper. And so, he was at a hotel, finished his Peace Corps commitment, at a hotel just outside of Bangkok. And he didn't know, how do you become a monk? So he asked the concierge at the hotel. And in those days, a concierge would know many places where Westerners would go, but he didn't know much about the hotel, the places to become monks. But he did know one thing. He said there was this royal temple in the middle of Bangkok where every now and again there was a Western monk. And that was the monastery called Wat Bawon. It was a royal temple. And so the concierge said, what you should do is get some food in the morning, go early and go to Wat Bawon and the royal temple. And then when you see a monk come out on arms round at dawn, give some food into the monk's bowl and then ask him that, you know, you want to become a monk. And then he will sort of take you in hand afterwards. And it's totally silly advice, that's not how it works. But that's what he did. And so he got to this temple so early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning. It was all locked up. And there was no one around. And so he did not know what to do. It'd be another couple of hours before the monks came out on the arms round. It had to be light before they came out. So he was wandering, walking up and down, not knowing what to do with some food there ready for the monks. And then, not knowing what to do, he's approached by this Thai man, a Thai gentleman, who could speak perfect English, and asked him what he was doing. And when he said that he wanted to become a monk, and this is the advice he was told, this Thai gentleman told him, well, you know, the monks aren't going to come out for another hour and a half or 2 hours. But he said, you know, I've got the keys so I can let you inside and show you around until the monks come out. So he took out these keys and opened up these iron gates in front of the Upostha hall, that's the ordination hall, and took this American inside and turned on the lights in the main hall. And in those traditional old Upostha halls, the main halls, they have these paintings inside, the murals. And this Thai gentleman, he just was so knowledgeable about the paintings inside the hall of Wat Bawon. If ever you go and see these temple paintings, it is like a cartoon. There's a chronology about it. But sometimes it's not like in Western cartoons from left to right, and then the next line. They go all over the place, and sometimes you have to trace the story. If you know the story, you can actually figure it out, how it works. Mostly Jataka tales, stories from the life of the Buddha, Dhammapada tells. Some of these are very well-known stories. But this fellow just knew everything about these stories. And it was so fascinating, not just their stories, but actually how they came to be painted. They were sponsored. And sometimes by a person who, you know, they lost their child in childbirth, they wanted to make some good karma for them, or they had some other difficulty or tragedy in life, some sickness, and they made the vow that if they recover, they'll sponsor one of these paintings in this hall. And the American said that this was just amazing information. The time flew past, and it was really interesting. And after they just finished, it was amazing timing, because he finished just in time, and he said, the monks will be coming out soon. You go, you know, and stand outside, and wait for this, an old monk will come out, and he described him. He's the one to put food in the bowl, because he's the senior monk, and he will take you back inside to start the process of becoming a monk. So the American went outside, and this gentleman just turned off the lights and closed everything up, locked it up. And of course, he saw this monk exactly as predicted, put food in the bowl, and said he wanted to become a monk. And he said, just wait here till I come back, and then I'll take you inside. So he took him inside the monastery afterwards and started the process of learning how to be a monk. There's many things you have to learn. You know, some of the rules, even if you don't know the rules and you break them, it's no excuse. So that's why you be very careful to train everybody and to do the chanting correctly. But after a few days, he complained. He said, the monk who was training him, he said his English wasn't very good. And so he sometimes misunderstood what this monk was saying. And he said, have you not got anyone else in this monastery who speaks better English? And they said, no, this is the best we have. You know, this was in Thai. This is the best English speaker we have. And at that point, the American said, well, what about that temple attendant I met early on the first morning? He spoke perfect English. What temple attendant, they asked. The one who spoke to me, who opened the gates and led me in and gave me this tour around the main hall. And at that, they immediately took him to the abbot, the Somdet Nyanasangwara, who became the head monk of Thailand a little bit later. And in the abbot's office, he was listening to him, and then he stopped him and said, call in the secretary, start from the beginning. Because there is no temple attendant like that who speaks perfect English, nor anyone other than the abbot, I think, and somebody else, who had the keys to go through that gate, because that is the royal gate, just opposite Mahamukut Foundation. Only kings and princes go through that gate, because that is a temple where they get ordained. You know, sometimes only temporarily, but all the kings of Thailand, they have to get ordained, and that's the temple where they get ordained. That's the gate only the royalty can go through. I went past that many times. It was always locked. I can't go through that temple, through that gate, to go around another gate. That's the royal gate, and I know that. And he said, no layperson has got the keys to the main hall. And he said, you can't turn on the lights there. The lights are around the back. And he said, no one, not even the head monk, the abbot, knew all the details of who sponsored what and why. Because that hall was built about 200 years ago, no, not maybe 120, 130 years, Suwadi, by the one who bought it was King Rama the fourth, okay, King Rama the fourth. That was Mahamukut. Yeah. So anyway, I said King Mongkut, basically. King Mongkut. And anyway, the abbot was listening to this and everything was written down because this was that weird. That gentleman did not exist. No one had those keys. You weren't allowed to go through that. It was so strange that at the end, the abbot, Somdetjana Sangmava, asked him, what did that gentleman look like? And he said one thing, first of all, he was wearing old traditional Thai clothes, not modern clothes. He said, but what else did he look like? And I said, he was Thai, you know, they all look the same. Or something like that. He wasn't being disrespectful, but I said, give me something, you know, what did it look like? You know what happens when you get sort of confused and you're scratching your head and you're looking at, and he froze. That's him. Had a painting, a portrait of the gentleman. That was him. He was a good fellow. Is that painting, the portrait. And the reason why that portrait was there, because it was King Mongkut. King Rama the Fourth, who died over 120 years earlier or something. And that's who he saw. That's the person who helped him when he wanted to become a monk, who opened doors which only the kings can go through. That's why he could go through that. It was a royal gate, and a royal member of the royal family, even though he was deceased, took him through. And it's why he knew all about those paintings, because he was there when it was sponsored. And that person became a monk, and he was up in the northeast for a while, I knew him, and then he went over to the United States. I don't know what happened to him since. But I've checked even that story with people who walk for one. It's absolutely true. That's what happened. It's part of the history of a Wat Pho Wan temple, of an old, deceased king. A long time ago, who sponsored that temple, opened doors for a person who wanted to become a monk. That's one of the most well-documented Deva stories. Heavenly beings, an old king of Thailand, obviously in a heavenly realm, coming down to help someone become a monk, just like in the time of the Buddha. That's true. I know people who are involved in that. So Samma Samadhi is often described as the four jhanas. But what is Samma Samadhi here and now, as in this moment, with this awareness? It is the Samma Samadhi has not been experienced, if you're just ordinary awareness. He may call it Samadhi, but it's not Samma Samadhi. It's not stillness. You're still restless. The five hindrances are still there. So in other words, the potential is there for you. If you just relax and open up the lotus, then maybe that Samma Samadhi is inside that lotus called you right now, but it's invisible, it's just a potential, because you have not let go enough yet. So the Samma Samadhi is not visible to you. That's what Samma Samadhi means. It always means the jhanas, nothing else. Dear Chambam, can we attain the fourth jhana by doing this breathing meditation? Is fourth jhana nirvana? No, it's not nirvana, but it's close. So close that, you know, it gave me goosebumps when I read it in the Pali. That description of even first jhana, fourth jhana is refinement, going deeper and deeper into that first jhana. Said that the happiness is called Sambodhi Sukha. Sambodhi means enlightenment. So the Buddha described the experience in a first jhana, just the first jhana, as enlightenment happiness. It's not enlightenment, but it's so close to the feeling of it, the bliss. The Buddha gave it that amazing term, enlightenment happiness. But the breathing, remember what I was saying with the different vehicles. You use an aircraft to come from overseas to Perth. You use a vehicle, a taxi or a car to come into Jhana Grove. and then you have to walk, you know, to your cottage, and then from your cottage you can walk to the front here and you leave your shoes outside. Each of those vehicles, the aircraft, the car, the shoes, and barefoot, they can only each get you so far, and then you have to let go of the coarser vehicle to use the more refined vehicle. You cannot land a 737 inside a Jhana Grove retreat center. Although maybe those, what was it, the Boeing 737 MAX or whatever, which crashed. Maybe that might have tried. But real aircraft, they can't fit through the door. So you have to use their big vehicles as far as they can take you. And then you use a more refined vehicle. And then a more refined vehicle until you come into the mind, into the jhanas. So the breathing only takes you so far. As far as the breathing can take you, then these nimittas take over. The nimittas take you as far as they can take you to the doorways of the jhanas, and then the bliss takes over. Different vehicles for different times. And it's a fourth jhana, nirvana, no, but it's pretty close. Why did it take a long time for Nanda to become enlightened? Because he wasn't in a rush. Not like you people. You think, oh my goodness, I've only got a few more days left, and so I'd better sort of get on with it. Who knows what's going to happen? Ajahn, do you still learn from other people? Of course. I'm always learning new jokes. What was that terrible joke Anusha told today? Why did the toilet roll go downhill? It was trying to reach the bottom. Toilet roll. So I'm always willing to learn from other people. What I learn from other people, I don't know if it's good or bad. But anyhow. Dear Ajahn, thank you for all your teachings. I feel so blessed to be able to learn from you. I have a few questions about meditation. When I meditate first thing in the morning, I find I have a lot more thoughts than in the afternoon. What can I do about this? Meditate in the afternoon and go to sleep in the morning. I don't know. So why in the morning? It could be so many different things. Maybe because when you get up, you have a cup of coffee or something, and of course you'll have lots of thoughts because you'll put big buzz of caffeine inside of you. Or you have a cup of tea. It could also be, I'm not quite sure, your habit in the morning to start thinking a lot. So when you meditate first thing in the morning, lots of thoughts, why not sort of get up middle of the night? Change things. Do things slightly differently. So there's no real reason except basically habit. So if you have a lot more thoughts in the morning, it must mean you have some more energy in the morning. If you have more energy in the morning, just make resolutions that when I start meditating in the morning, I'm going to, say, do some walking meditation first, which is really good. You do walking meditation early in the morning. You haven't got your eyes closed, so you can't live in your fantasy realm. You're out there watching things with your eyes. Only just a couple of feet in front of you. It means you can't think so much. When one has a nimitta, including dull ones, will I be aware of this? Like saying, here it is. If you say, here it is, you say, now it's here, now it's gone. That's the trouble with nimittas. If you try and speak at them, their nimittas are very shy. You mention their name, and they run away. So, if you say, here it is, they'll be embarrassed and go away. So that's just a little simile there. So, if the nimitta is here, don't say anything. Otherwise, they will run away. Well, what was it like that I've given a couple of talks over in Johor Bahru, which were organized in a hotel ballroom, because one of the royal family, the Sultan's family, would like to come to my talks. But, you know, she has to be a Muslim. So I was told, just don't mention her name. Because if you mention her name, she might get embarrassed and she would just like want to go away. Because she might get into trouble. So that's one of the reasons why, that sometimes you just keep things quiet. Otherwise they have to go away. Like Nimittas are like that. The royal family of meditation states. So, if you say Nimitta, maybe say, oh, I'd better be out of here. When Nimitta appears, does one feel peaceful or happy, i.e. blissful? Yes. Either peaceful or happy, or sometimes both. Dear Acharya, Sutta and Gutra Nikaya 937 with Ananda, where the eye will be informed and yet one will not be sensitive to that dimension. Ananda said the arahat is percipient and not sensitive to that dimension. Can you please explain? No, because I have to see the whole thing. Because sometimes, how many suttas are there in the Anguttara Nikaya? How many pages? I think it's about 1500 pages in there. And I do not have the memory of every page of every sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. So, 937, where the eye will be informed and yet one will not be sensitive to that dimension. First of all, whenever you see the, even translations, you have to look at the Pali to see what the translation is. But anyway, the eye will be informed and yet not be sensitive to that dimension. I'm not quite sure exactly what the context is, but what they usually say is you have all the apparatus for sight, for that first sense, and you'll not be sensitive to that dimension. That must be usually, I would expect, the only way you're not sensitive to that dimension is, in other words, you're not picking it up, is you must be in the anagami realm, where the five senses have disappeared for the time being, or you're in the jhana realm. So another said, arahat is not percipient, is percipient but not sensitive to that dimension. Really have to look at see what they're saying. If they're percipient to that dimension, then it means that they're open to it. And not sensitive to that dimension must mean that they are not going to be troubled by it. Anyway, that is just a stab in the dark, because you have to see the whole sutta, and preferably in Pali, to get to know. Because sometimes people have these really weird translations. And some of these weird translations, such as, like, you know, the description of the jhanas. They say the first jhana has got applied and sustained thought. Vitakka vichara. Come on. Anyone who's done any meditation know that thinking is a hindrance. It's disturbing. So when it gets to the jhanas, that there's no thinking left at all. So what the vitakka vichara means in those jhanas, it's subverbal. You're not sort of saying anything. If you can say anything, if you can ask, is this jhana? If you can ask that, obviously it's not. No way. Because jhana is far more refined than that. So what it is just the mind moving onto the object, subverbally, holding the object. You're not doing this, it happens by itself. What I call the wobble of the first jhana. So sometimes the bliss is so strong. What you're aware of, in even the first jhana, is just incredible bliss. What sometimes people of other religions would call unity with God, just pure love, incredible ecstasy, these are all saying the same thing. And you've just got incredible, powerful bliss. But because you're still holding it slightly, it makes it unstable. So it's just, you move a little bit away from it, as it were, and you get sucked straight back in. It's just too powerful. And that creates this wobble. Getting sucked back in is called a vitakka, going onto it. And then just the holding it, it's called the vichara. The commentary made a decent stab at a simile. Just like you ring the bell, that's the vitakka. And the resonance is the vichara. So the vichara is gone, the resonance, so you tick it again. But then there comes a time, you don't need to actually to strike the bell anymore, it starts to resonate by itself. Sustaining for a long period of time. So you don't need to strike anything, the vitaka goes, you've only got the vichara. And after a while you just totally let go, and then the vitaka vichara disappears and you just got this beautiful peace and bliss. But anyway, do you understand that? Probably not. Just like the little tadpole has to leave the water before it really understands these things, but that's actually some of the translations which people have sometimes. My goodness. So to part of being a good translator is having an understanding of what they're describing from personal experience. Anyway, since today is a full moon night, can you see the full moon outside tonight? It's a full rain night tonight. Can you use your superpowers to zap us all to get jhanas, nibbidas, something, please? Zap, 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 zap. Did it work? If you could do that, you wouldn't need to spend all this time doing this meditation retreat and all these talks and all these interviews. You just come on a full moon night, just one night, zap, get jhanas, and tomorrow morning go home, enlightened. Really efficient. Anyway, in my interview I mentioned I noticed a screen of awareness behind sounds, tastes, etc. with regard to the screen. Is this something to be cultivated? It can be, because what it does, it's just a way of looking, a skillful means. Like I mentioned, like you see like like on a TV screen, on a computer screen, and just then you can see all this stuff up, but all these things happening on the computer screen, with the six channels. It's not Foxtel with 160, I don't know really what I'm talking about. How many channels are there on CNN, whatever? Anyway, you know that sometimes people say, oh, there's hundreds of channels on the TV, but on your TV there's only six. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching and knowing. The six senses. That's the only channels you've got. And sometimes people do that, they switch over, they surf. Seeing, no, nothing much seeing. So, anything to hear? Now, any feeling? Smelling? Taste? Let's go and have something to eat. And sometimes just knowing, fantasies. But then what happens is sometimes there's no sight channel anymore. It's turned off. And you can't sort of connect to it. The connection is down to sight, to hearing, to smell, taste, touch. You turn them off. But anyway, just seeking like a screen sometimes is a good metaphor, useful means. If you have a screen, then sometimes you can say, think that you are watching the screen from a distance. So you put space between you and what you're experiencing. And that means that what you put in between the observed, the felt, the known, and your mindfulness. Not that mindfulness is no different than anything else, or is separate, or is an independent entity masquerading as your soul or self. It's just a way of looking. And then whatever you're looking at, you can actually put between you and the object of your awareness, wanting, or just contentment. So ill will, control, or just letting go and peace. So whatever you're experiencing, you can always remember to make peace with it. Or you can make war with it. And sometimes it's what you put in between you and the object which you're experiencing. And if you can learn sort of a little skillful means like that, it doesn't really matter what the object that you're meditating on, what you're experiencing. What really does matter is like how you meditate on it. Do you make peace, be kind, be gentle with what you're experiencing? Or do you want to control it and get rid of it and make war with it? So it doesn't really matter what your meditation object is. What's really crucial is what you're doing with it. You can make peace, be kind, be gentle. You're just slowly in its own time, it just transforms into something really, really beautiful. Just like that anger-eating monster. If you make peace with it, you're kind to it, you're gentle, the monsters disappear, or sometimes they become your buddies and your best friends. Hi, monster. Always helping you. So that's actually, it's not what you meditate on, how you meditate. It's more important. That's one way of doing it. Looking at the screen. What is important, so in the context of the Eightfold Path? It is just a useful means. And the Eightfold Path, I was just mentioning the second factor of the Eightfold Path, one of the most important, right Samasankhapa. Some people call it right intention, and some people even call it right thought, which is really off the planet. Off the Buddha planet, that is. It's really weird. But the best translation, if you look for what it actually says and what it's defined as, it becomes like right motivation, where you're coming from. Because it's thoughts of letting go, or intentions, it's coming from a place of letting go and renunciation. Not trying to attain something or get something, but renouncing, letting go, abandoning, simplifying. So that's the first of the right sankhapas. Letting go, and kindness, this avyapada, and harmlessness, ahimsaka. Now, which everybody knows that, thanks to Mahatma Gandhi. You know, ahimsa, not harming. And that is the second part of the Eightfold Path. And the reason why I really sort of focused on that is because compassion, kindness was such an important part of Buddhism, and where was it in the Eightfold Path? I can never see right metta or right kindness. Is kindness part of Buddhism? And of course, when you looked a bit closer, it's right in the middle of the second factor of the Eightfold Path. So actually, to come from places of kindness, places of letting go, places of harmlessness. That is straight Eightfold Path, number two. That's why sometimes you see these T-shirts, make peace, be kind, be gentle, Ajahn Brahm. I did say that, but the Buddha said, renounce, be kind, and be gentle. So I don't really mind, but if you actually quoted the Buddha and with my name on the end, that's really, really not that good. But that's the Eightfold Path, and that's sometimes you see the screen, make peace, be kind, be gentle, with whatever you see on the screen. Is cessation the realization that even this awareness ends? Cessation is not an experience. Yeah, awareness ends, everything ends. There's nothing left. There was a visual aid which I had for many years, and then someone took it away to auction it, I think for the nuns' monastery. I sacrificed even cessation. Because what it was a machine, and so you had a little switch on the top, it's just an ordinary box, and you turn the switch, and once the switch was turned, a little hand came out and turned the machine off, and went back inside, and that was it. It was a machine whose only purpose was to turn itself off. And I thought, that is a summary of the meaning of life. To become enlightened, so you turn yourself off. Gone. I thought it was really cool. Anyway, lastly, is an answer when we get caught up in the object and forget about the screen? Well, it's one way of looking at it, but I like the answer was, you go out into the world. So look, you're sitting comfortably, peaceful here, nothing going on, and then you think, is it time for lunch? You've gone out into the future. Or, you know, somebody makes a noise. And it's nothing to do with you. Stay inside. But you go out to sort of wondering who that was and, you know, what you're going to do to them afterwards. Or, no, you're going out from where you belong inside. That's the outflowings. The outflowings into the future. You know, from the present moment into the future. What's going to happen next? Are they going back into the time? You know, where did I come from? What happened? It all goes out from your center. So that's the outflowings. So anyway, hope you understood that. If not, never mind. You don't have to understand everything. And that's one of the reasons. No one's actually asked me, why did I tell that story of those the most amazing music in the whole world, the supernatural music, and those four doors, the wooden door, the steel door, and the silver door, and the gold door. Now, why did I tell that? Was it just to give you a hard time, to sort of build you up and just get you excited about the most amazing and then let you down by saying only monks can know the secret of that? The reason was, I tell that story, is why do people have to know everything? Is it really important to know? Or is it an exercise in the craving, that type of craving called curiosity? Which is a type of craving. I have to know. And it's nothing to do with enlightenment. But I have to know. Do you really need to know what the most amazing music is? So sometimes there's many types of craving. And that craving to know and to understand. Anyway, there are some phenomena in nature, such as the decay of some radioactive particles. They're said to be completely random. That is probabilistic, according to the equations of quantum mechanics. How does this tie with cause and effect? Well, can one just say that there are causes that lead to completely random outcomes? Yes, like your enlightenment. Is it going to actually happen or not happen? It's much to do with like Murphy's law. It can happen because, and it happens because it can happen. And many millions and billions of little atoms decaying, so they can say they have a half-life. But if the atoms, if they go, where do they go to? They decay. They just change into other particles, or do they? How can this universe appear out of nothing? Or was there something before? There is something called the conservation of mass energy. So you can change particles from one to another, they decay, they either decay to something else or into energy. So mass and energy, when you add them all up together, they're supposed to always be constant. So where did all this mass energy of the universe come from? And the answer is pretty easy to understand. Imagine that all this mass energy, every star including dark matter and energy, imagine it all came together. All came together. What would happen? A big ball of energy? Or would it totally cancel each other out? Because there is something, like many of you know, even from school, called potential energy, which is a negative type of energy. To take this box and to actually to free it from the Earth's gravitational field will take up a lot of energy of this box. So any massive particle in a gravitational field or any other force field has a negative energy component. So imagine all the negative energy components of the universe. And all the positive energy that all comes together, maybe it cancels each other out. If I could collect every bit of energy in the whole universe, every bit of mass and put it together, it disappears. Nothing left. Years and years and years ago, when I was doing a little conference and just presenting with our local professor of physics, David Blair, that I mentioned what happened. is the positive and negative energy of the universe exactly balanced and cancel each other out. And I remember him turning around looking at me, "Wow, Ajahn Brahm, you are really up to date. Omega equals one." And that was the balance. So, this universe, when it comes together, there's nothing left. Poof. Completely balances. Just like your stream of consciousness. Everything comes together. Zero sum energy. Boom. And you're gone. Nothing destroyed. It's just balance, come together, poof. Gone. Forever. I think that's really cool, because that's actually the nature of stuff. There we go. Modern physics for you. It's nice to actually being among us, thinking outside the box. Because you know that sometimes that people, you know, from especially Christianity said, "Okay, you monks, where did this world come from? Who created this world? Where did it begin? So why does it have to have a beginning? Why does it have to have an end?" Because I like this little piece of logic. Many, about 4 or 5 centuries ago, everybody thought the earth was flat. And they thought Australia was the center of the world. If you lived in Australia. If you lived in Rome or Greece, the Mediterranean Sea, because that was the middle land. If you were in the Ganges Valley, that was the middle land. If you were in China, that was the middle kingdom. We always tend to think we're the center of things. And when we knew that there was other countries, we still thought this world was flat. And if you sailed in a boat far enough, you'll fall off the edge of the world. And people were really scared of that. And so to get somebody to actually get in a boat and keep on sailing, they really thought that was the end. They'd never come back, fall off the edge of the world, because the earth was flat. But now, we are so knowledgeable. We all know that this earth is round. It's a sphere. It's got limited space, limited area. That's why real estate is so hard to buy. It's not infinite space. But it's got no edges to it. Planet Earth has got no beginning, no end. You can sail as far as you like and you never fall off the edge. It is a sphere with no boundaries. That is planet Earth. But then you go to the next level, the universe. If you travel fast enough, faster than the speed of light, at warp speed 10. Remember Star Trek? I remember Star Trek, Captain Spock. He was really cool. But anyway, to go walk really fast to the other end of the universe. Will you come to the edge of the universe? And I remember thinking like that when I was a school kid. What happens if you go far enough? Is there a wall built by Mr. Trump to stop aliens invading? Make this universe great again. Or is that like in Singapore where you have this barbed wire fence with these pictures of somebody being shot? What would it be like at the end of the universe? And after a while, I spent hours trying to contemplate, was it just like a hole, a drop, or what happened at the end of the universe? Because it couldn't go on forever. That was actually Obler's paradox, if anyone wants to check that out, that, you know, proved that, you know, this universe cannot go on forever. It has to be a limited volume. But then, where's its boundaries? And then, of course, you learnt, you know, thanks to good old Albert, Mr. Einstein, that this universe is curved. It's not a flat universe. In other words, if you go far enough, fast enough, you come back to where you started. If you did have a spacecraft which could go at warp speed a billion, you set off from Jhana Grove, you come back right here. Just like the earth is curved, so is the universe. So this universe, the limited space, finite space, without any edges, no beginnings and no ends. And every astrophysicist knows that and agrees with that. But the next level, time. People still believe that time is flat, not curved. So if you go far enough back in time, if you manage to get the secret of Doctor Who's TARDIS, and they still have TARDIS. Doctor Who's still alive. But anyway, she's a girl now. So, if you go in TARDIS, can you go back to time? Really back to the beginnings of time? Is there an edge to time, a beginning? If there is a beginning of time, there will be an end of time. Both make no sense to me. What happens at the beginning of time? Is there a wall again? Or is there a barbed wire fence? No further back. This was the beginning. What was before the beginning? But it never made any sense until you realized the problem was the same as flat earth. And this is the myth of flat time. Imagine that time wasn't flat, but curved, like planet earth, like the universe. No boundaries, but limited in extent. Circular time goes round and round.
That's enough to keep you thinking and keep you awake tonight.
The answer to the beginning of time, there wasn't one. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please, please, please tell the story of the thief who stole the wrong thing from the monk? The first time I heard, I wanted to cry but couldn't, as I was in the Sydney City Circle train during peak hour. What are you doing listening to that in the train? Anyway. Anyway, that's a nice little story. It's based on several occasions where similar things happened, but I just changed the simile to modern times. So, in a temple somewhere, in the middle of the night, the head monk, the abbot, woke because he heard a sound coming from the main shrine room. And it was about 2:30 in the morning. And first of all he thought, one of my monks has got up early to meditate. And then he contemplated, reflected, no, my monks will get up. He wasn't a cynic, he was a realist. So he decided to get up and investigate. So he got up and went into the shrine room. There was a burglar, a thief there, with a knife, trying to open the donation box. And the head monk said, "What are you doing? None of your business! Shut up! Or I'll knife you!" And he said, "Are you trying to get some money from the donation?" He said, "Yes! None of your business! Shut up!" And in one hand, he had the knife, one in his eye was looking at the monk in case a monk might try something. Because some of these monks do martial arts. They're not to be taken lightly, some of these monks. So the monk just put his hand in his pocket. "What are you getting?" And he picked out the keys, the donation box keys. He said, "These are the keys to the donation box. Here, help yourself. Those donations are for charity, to help poor people like you. Take some money." And he handed the keys to this monk. And the monk was looking at him. He was really suspicious. But he took the keys and he still was pointing the knife in the direction of the monk as he opened the donation box and emptied the donation box into his pockets. with their context, not the box. And the monk looked at him and noticed he was very thin and very, very, a lot of suffering. And he said, "When was the last time you eaten?" "None of your business." "Well, I know it's none of my business, but just in the cupboard above the donation box, you'll find some leftover food from this morning's meal. Help yourself." "Is this a trick?" "No, help yourself." And so the thief took some of the food. And as he filled his pockets with the food and the money, he was about to go and run away and said, "Don't you call the police." And the monk said, "Why should I? I've given you the money and I've given you the food. Just go in peace." And so the thief, ran away. And in the morning, you know, when the committee came and they saw there was not much money in the box, they said, "Now what happened?" And he told the story of, you know, this thief. And they said, "Well done. It's nice that, you know, there are monks who are not attached, who care about people more than donations." And sometimes you look at monks and nuns in this world, religious people, and they just want to try and get as much donations out of you as possible, instead of actually just people being kind. They said, "Wow, that's a real monks and nuns we really like." And so they were very proud of their monk. And the next couple of days, in the newspaper, the monk saw that thief had been captured, arrested, because not everyone is kind as that monk. So he got arrested and he was sentenced to 10 years in jail. 10 years later, or 10 years and one day later, the monk, now a bit older, woke in the middle of the night at 2:30. Someone was in the shrine room. He thought he was being robbed again. So he went into that shrine room. And who did he see? His friend, the burglar. 10 years older, but still with a knife, trying to open the donation box. And the burglar shouted out, "Do you remember me?" "Yeah, I remember you. Here's the keys. Help yourself." At which the thief said, "Put the keys away." As he put the knife down. And he said, "I was released from jail yesterday. I've been thinking of you every night for the last 10 years. You're the only person I've ever known who was kind to me. Who actually, even though I was pointing a knife at you, was not worried about your own safety, but saw how hungry I was and gave me food and money, and you never called the police. I never experienced anyone like you before. And I realized after all those years in my cell that I've stolen the wrong thing. I've come to steal again from you, monk. But now I want to steal the secret of your happiness and your kindness and your peace. Please ordain me as a monk." Because that's always what I really wanted. That is the wealth he stole the second time. This time it was the right wealth. Well, that's a really nice story. But that was, even recently, I forget where I read this, there was a story of a monk in Thailand. This is a real story. Well, there's a couple of stories like this on which this story was based. That there was some head monk, I think it was in a Yuta temple, and there was some thieves that were stealing some mattresses from the monastery. And so he saw them, and as soon as he saw them, they put all the mattresses, you know, in their boat and started rowing away. He said, hold on a minute. He said, "You know, you have a mattress, you do need pillows as well." And, you know, they didn't believe this at first of all, but they, "Well, no, look, it's a fair, won't call the police." And so they came back and he put pillows in the boat for them. He said, "Thank you," and off they went. He was so kind. Even though they were donated for the monks, "You take it, you need it more than we do." It was really kind. That was a true story years ago. Anyway, next one. "Please tell us the story of how Bodhinyana Maharshi was saved
in a severe storm a few years ago. That is not exactly the story, because I know Bodhinyana Monastery had a big fire many years ago, but this was the storm when we had our 30th anniversary of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And, is any of you there then? Are you there then? Do you actually at the, excellent. Because, Ajahn Bhamali, who you know, that he is, he's really skeptical. He didn't believe in holy water. He does actually sprinkle other people with holy water, does the chanting. But he said this was one thing he has to admit it was something magical and amazing. And that was when 30th year of our Buddhist Society, Western Australia, and the president of that time, the young guy Sol, he decided that, you know, we should do something. We'd come a long way and we should have a celebration. And when he mentioned that to me, he said, oh, just let's have a small celebration on the South Perth foreshore. And I said, no way. If we're going to do something, we're going to do it big. Maybe because I was a Leo. So if you're going to do something, you know, do it properly. So I said, let's get the centre of Perth. Supreme Court Gardens? That's where they have big celebrations and festivals, right in the middle of town. I said, it won't be free. So we rang up the Perth Council. It was free that evening. It was a Sunday evening, the full moon night, Waisak, May. And so it was free. And so we started asking, can people come? And even the Premier of Western Australia, you know, the head politician, a fellow called Jeff Gallop, we called him up, said, yeah, I'm in, I'll come. And we had a few other people coming. Everything just was all working. I had to spend a lot of money, because this was going to be our big event saying that Buddhism has come to West Australia after 30 years. And so, you know, I was in charge. We got a big golden Buddha statue from Thailand. And we had all of these people helping out. And didn't worry about the costs. You're going to do it, just forget about the costs. We pay the bills afterwards. And that morning, so it's in May, it's supposed to be good weather. That morning when I woke up, it was raining. And I thought, well, it would pass by the evening, 7 o'clock when we had the event. But then, looked at the weather forecast. Storm. Storm warning. A dangerous storm is going to come and hit Perth between 7 o'clock and 8:30. Exactly the time when we're going to hold our ceremony. And when I got there, it was pouring down with rain. And I really noticed everybody, especially those Thais who were there, they were soaked to the skin. These were, Sompong, you were there, over there in the back, soaked to the skin, arranging things. They didn't mind. They were just going to carry on. Three times the Premier's office called and somebody had a mobile phone. There's a Premier's office on the line for Ajahn Brahm. Are you cancelling? No way. Second time, the storm is going to come. And I said, no, we're not. Three times they said, are you cancelling? I said, no. And it was one of the monks, remember him, now Chris, he sort of grabbed me by the shoulder and sort of pulled me aside and said, Ajahn Brahm, you're embarrassing us. But there's a storm coming. There's no way we can do this ceremony. I mean, a really big storm. You know, come on. Well, yeah, I know that, you're a good monk and all that, but, you know, you've got to be reasonable and logical. Stop this. Nope. It's not talking to him. He said, oh, yeah, I know that happened. And then there's another fellow who took me aside too and said, look, I spent all my life in the Merchant Navy. I looked at the barometer and the sign, there's a storm coming. Don't be stupid, Ajahn Brahm. I said, no, we're going ahead.
sometimes you really have to stand your ground. And then I was in the tent. I remember this moment, remember it for the rest of my life. In the tent when sort of one of the ladies came, it was Cherry's mum, Shirley, and she also said, she was actually crying. I said, "Ajahn Brahm, come outside now." And I thought, what else could go wrong? Someone's had an injury or something. That's what I thought at the time. But when she dragged me outside this tent, and then she just pointed up, and the full Vaisak moon was appearing, the clouds had parted. And actually, she was a Burmese Buddhist, and she was crying her eyes out. The Vaisak moon, full, the clouds had parted. And a few minutes later, the premier came, and we did that ceremony. We did have a TV crew was there, and they're trying to interview me, but the person who was doing the interview was kept on saying, "This is weird. This is weird." And I remember just the way she said it, he kept on saying, "This is weird." We did the ceremony. And after the ceremony was finished, the rains came down and the freeway was flooded. And the field was under 2 or 3 inches of water. And people in Perth, our friends, they just refused to believe we held a ceremony. Because, you know, in the west, the east, the north and south, trees were coming down. It was a real storm. I said, "How could you do the ceremony there?" I said, "Yeah, no rain." There was actually a drizzle in the middle for about 1 minute. Only very light, but held the ceremony, no problem at all. And to cap it, the hire firm, it was Reese Hire, that they hired all the tents and the tables and the electrics and everything, and they wrote this email to me. Actually, it was actually to one of the organisers who I delegated to do this. And she showed me the email. And the head of the company said, "We've never heard of this Ajahn Brahm before, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing tomorrow?" I remember that email. It's really funny. That was a true story. But, you know, when those things happen, you know, okay, don't need to believe it's only a tiny storm, it was a big storm. But afterwards we took the Buddha statue back, cleaned up, 11 o'clock at night or something, 11:30, and just totally exhausted. You had a couple of hours sleep, got up in the morning because I was going to Melbourne for their Vaisak. I had to go to the airport. And when I got to the airport, checked in, another half an hour before the plane left, I just sat in the corner and cried. I wept. Not sadness, just the inspiration. Because what you've done is something wonderful, amazing. And sitting in the corner, just crying my eyes out, because now I could stop and reflect on what's happened. The inspiration was huge. And I remember that. I don't know what people thought seeing a monk crying. You know, "Have you lost your ticket?" But no, it's just, that was really, even now, it's just the power of that, what happens. It was really good. Anyway, again, I wanted to finish off early tonight, but please don't get me involved in inspirational stuff because I can't resist it. If everything is energy, why didn't the Buddha mention it much like there was a huge emphasis in Hinduism? Your thoughts on the Buddha and energy. Just in energy. I already mentioned that, just zero energy. So when everything comes together, peace, instead of energy, can sometimes be destructive. So isn't it wonderful to get some final peace? There's nothing left, zero sum. I found that much better. As I said the other day, nothing is better than God. Dear Ajahn, thank you for this wonderful retreat center and your amazing teachings. Once when I was sitting poised to book a retreat with my finger hovering over the I'm in button, my teenage son commented, "Chill, Mum, it's not a rock concert." My reply, "The entertainment is far better. if only you know. And indeed, one of my CVs was Lady Gaga was visiting Jakarta to give a concert. At the same time, the same day, I was giving a talk in Medan in Sumatra. And I think my hall had about 4,000 or 5,000 capacity. I think hers had maybe about 1,000 in Jakarta somewhere. And my talk, it booked out in about 10 minutes. Her talk took about 40 minutes. So the MC said, Azam Brown is more famous than Lady Gaga. I don't know if I really approve of that comparison, but I'll take it. So why not? But it's true, it's very hard to get on these retreats. Why? Ajahn Brahm, thank you for being so kind. You rock. You mean I'm just moving backwards and forwards when I'm meditating? Would you please recommend a few good, easy-to-read books on Buddha and Buddha's student stories? In English, please. It's a nice way to learn insights and even great to read to my children one day. You know, it's really hard to get kids' books. So that's why, again, good old Indonesians, they did Kangaroo Guru. It's like cartoons. But I think more grown-up people read it than kids do. Kangaroo Guru. So it's really nice. You know, the guru of the kangaroos. So it just sounds good, you know, Kangaroo Guru. I try really hard to push these things. But, yeah, I mean, if you can get sort of cartoon books, kids love cartoon books. A great cartoon book of Buddhism for kids is Peanuts and Garfield. Well, I think Garfield is a bit indulgent. But, no, for kids. Sometimes don't push it on kids, you know, just let them read nice little stories, it's up to them. Do you not have any dealings with Amarwati UK anymore? Yeah, I do. So, sometimes secret behind the scenes. So, of course you have dealings with them, they're still friends. That's because they're ordaining the big Kunis. So they got a bit embarrassed, but, you know, still friends. They may not be friends with me, but I'll always be friends with them. So remember all of that. So it doesn't matter how anybody does things, they thought it was the right thing at the time. So, yeah, they may not. If you ever have a falling out with a person, they don't like you. You say, okay, they may not invite you, they may not be friends to you, but you always be friends with them. That's the right way of doing things. That's a nice memories, you know, of all these monks. I was just telling even Ajahn Amaro, he's now the abbot of Amarwati. And he's an amazing family, because when he first, you know the story of Ajahn Amaro of Amarwati? That he finished his psychology degree, and then he had a friend of a friend of a friend who was exporting horses, you know, to race in Singapore. And according to the rules, if you are transporting a horse, like a racehorse, to Singapore for the races, you had to have about 3 or 4 grooms on the plane, you know, with the horse, just in case. And, you know, he knew, you know, one end of a horse from another, you know, so, you know, his mate said, do you want a free ride to Singapore? I said, yeah, sure. So he got a free ticket to Singapore just to look after a horse. And then as soon as he was in Singapore, he was free to come back to London slowly, like a gap year sort of thing. And so he'd gone through Malaysia and southern Thailand. He was in Bangkok. And he was staying in some place where there was some of these doctors working in a refugee camp. And the refugee camp in Ubon was run by what's the children thing? Save the Children Fund. No, they were working in there. And so the doctors, you know, the friend said, you know, do you want to come up to Ubon? You know, have a stay with us for a few days in the camp. And he said, well, why not? So he got up to Ubon, and there's nothing there in Ubon. It's not the sort of place you get tourists. It's flat, food's terrible.
There's no sort of amazing sights to see like in Chiang Mai or great beaches like in Phuket. You know, it's pretty sort of dull. But they said, oh, at least there's some Western monks. You know, and that was in Wat Nanachat, next to Ajahn Chah's monastery. And so he said his name was Jeremy Horner. And so he went there. I was there at the time. And, you know, he came there, just this young English man. And, you know, he was only just coming for a look. And then he actually asked the abbot, said, oh, is it all right if I stay overnight? I said, yeah, sure. And when he was overnight, in the morning, when we went on arms round, he'd already shaven his head. And he said, can I be a monk? And he didn't know Buddhism at all. But something had really got to him. And he shaved his own head one night without being asked and wanted to become a monk the next day. And so, you know, obviously, let him try being a monk. And, you know, because I did all the visas and said, oh, Jeremy Horner, are you related to I.B. Horner, who was the president of the Pali Text Society? He said, no, I don't know her at all. Oh, really? Okay, never mind. And Ajahn Chah had a hard time in Thai saying the word Jeremy, so he became known as Jeremy, which means in Thai, axle grease. So that was his nickname, axle grease. And if any of you go and see him, you could actually say that and just, you know, it's a bit of fun. So he doesn't mind that, but Ajahn axle grease. But then, you know, after ordaining, you know, his father had a heart attack in England, so, you know, straight away back to England, you know, to look after his father. And that's where, you know, his father recovered. And he asked his father, he said, are we any relation to this Professor I.B. Horner in Unum College in Cambridge, who was the head of the Pali Text Society? And his father's face dropped. Her. He said, that's your auntie. That's my sister. We never talk about her. The black sheep of the family. She was. And there was, as an Amaro, his auntie, we never knew, was a Pali scholar, Buddhist scholar, and he never knew that all his life. He never knew that she existed, which was weird. But he used to tell me, one of the reasons why, because his grandfather, was it grandfather or grandmother? Anyway, that she had these weird powers. Now, she would, with Jeremy, the phone was about to ring. He said, oh, that's Uncle George about to call. And it always was. And she could actually just know who's going to call. And that really upset her son, Jeremy's father. And that's why the father never wanted anything to do with anything weird, religious, psychic or whatever. And that's why I think he never told her about Irene Horner. But eventually, Irene Horner's getting very old. And then so he managed to get an appointment, so they met together once. So this Pali scholar, who wrote all these books in Pali, managed to meet her nephew for the first time, just before she passed away, which was really nice. But it doesn't finish there. I've told his story, but I don't mind. You know, his sister, Ajahn Amaro's sister, she had some sort of office job over in London. And, you know, then eventually she retired. And it was only then she let Sir Ajahn Amaro and the whole family know that she was MI6. She was a spy. And no one knew. Not just in the office, out in the field. But she had this amazing ability. She could look at, a whole sort of 10 or 12 page report on something, and she had this perfect photographic memory. And, you know, that was developed, and so she would go to, behind the Iron Curtain at the time, go to these places, and they would get these classified documents, and she would read it all. And then, you know, she would not carry anything. She'd go back to London and then just write it all out
perfect memory. So that's why she's a very effective agent. What a weird family that was. So, when I heard that, then I started telling people, where does all the money come for our monks' monastery and the Jhana Grove and the nuns' monastery? I go overseas and we get all these donations coming back. Where do they actually come from? So I tell people that, I really am a spy as well. This is just my cover. Every good spy has an alternate persona, so they can travel freely all over the place, and nobody actually knows what they really do. So what a great cover for a spy to be a monk. And this over here is not fat, this is my utility belt. Of course, that's all Go My Yang. That's not true, but of course a spy would say that, wouldn't they? This is a bit of entertainment for you. But sometimes the life is really weird. Anyway, that's, can you tell us how Jhana Grove and Bunyan Monastery are protected from ghosts if you tell us ghost stories? What do the monks do on a full moon day? Should lay people do anything special? Oh my crikey, you should go to bed at a reasonable time. It's always 9:30 already. Oh my goodness, I'm not going to finish these. So, protected from ghosts. This is a story of this wonderful lady who, I think Sompong will know her, Ratana K. Remember Kun Ratana? Years ago. But she, really nice Thai, very devout, and just, she was such a good worker here, and always really looking after the monks. But she had a mother who was over in Thailand, and so she invited her mother, the family visas, into Australia to look after her. And she would come to the temple. She couldn't speak any English. She was old, but spoke really good Thai, very devout Buddhist. And anyway, it came to the point that her mother started getting sick, coming towards the end of her life. So Ratana was in a hospital, but she wondered whether this was going to be her mother's last illness. So she went to one of these mediums here in Perth, and really good value for money, only 20 bucks. I never knew that. So he went to the medium and said, I want to know if my mother's going to survive this illness or not. I think she's not. And the medium said, I can do that for you. All I will need is the 20 bucks, the name of the hospital, the name of the ward, her room number and name. And I just astral travel. And I go into that plane and I check out your mum. And I come back. So this woman went into a trance and just disappeared for about 10 minutes. And as soon as she came back, out of the trance, she gave Ratana the 20 bucks back. And Ratana said, well, what's wrong? Didn't you find my mother? Oh yeah, I found your mother. I found the hospital, the ward, the room, and your mother's name on the outside, but I just couldn't get in. I said, I just couldn't get in the room. I'd never seen this before. She said, it was like there's this big force field around your mother, and I just couldn't penetrate it. So I'm sorry I couldn't find out for you, so that's why I gave the $20 back. And he said, who the heck is your mum? And she said, oh, she's a Buddhist nun. She's been a nun for about 30 or 40 years, the Mechi, the eighth preceptor. And at which point, the medium, who knew nothing about Buddhism, grabbed the $20 back and said, you've been wasting my time. So I deserve the $20. What she said, people like me can't get close to people like that. And that was a very clear message that any spirits, there's many other stories as well, but that's one of the clearest ones, any spirits or ghosts, if you keep precepts, if you're like monks or nuns, your power is immense. They can't get close to you unless you invite them in. So that's why you don't need to worry too much about ghosts and spirits, the real ones. Not sort of like, I think people won't really mind me telling this, after the ghost story last night, somebody that went to bed and they heard people walking outside. Outside their room. They heard it. And it was, you know, really awake, human footsteps, and it stopped right outside their window and knocked on the window. For they were brave enough to actually to open the window and see. And they saw it. Kangaroo. And I say that because many times many people, you know, have actually had that experience. Kangaroos at night time, they sound just like human beings walking. It's just the way they move. They don't hop, hop, hop. They just, you know, they lift up their feet and they put it down again. And, you know, sometimes they're chomping or even they brush past your window. It's a kangaroo. So, and of course, as soon as he opened the window, the kangaroo was scared and ran off. So be careful there. A lot of these things you think are ghosts. They're just animals in the forest at night time. You are protected. Okay. I think there's lots of more stories. I'll do these other stories tomorrow. Or maybe just do one more and then finish off tonight. Do skilled meditators experience nimittas every time they sit? Is that how they can sit for so long? No, not every time. Sometimes they experience jhanas, even better. Sometimes nothing at all. Sometimes they sit for long periods of time because they've got nothing else to do. Okay, but now the right time is to allow the body to disappear. To meditate flat out, which is what you're supposed to do on a full moon night. To actually to relax to the max and just encase yourself in the warm kindness of your duvet. Have a nice night. See you in the morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, have a nice night. Ooh, so many questions here. Okay. Maybe tomorrow, because coming to the end, close to the end of the retreat, only one question per person, please. So if you want to put a question in the morning, you think, well, maybe I should do another question. Find the first question and throw it away and replace it by the second question. And also, number two, if you do write a question, please not part A, part B, part C, part D, part E. Just one question. Because otherwise, you know, tomorrow night we'll be up all night just answering questions. Very good.